Schultz, and my first name is Ransom. I've been in Alaska for approximately 38 years. I came here in April 1938, and I've been flying around the country for many years on various assignments for both Alaska Airlines, and before it was Alaska Airlines, for Star Airlines, and I've put in 12 years for Wien Airlines and retired from that organization in 1966. Today, February 20th, 1975, I'd like to relate some of my experiences in and prior to the flood of Fairbanks in 1967. That was August 1967. For instance, following the 2 weeks of steady rain on the weekend of August 11th, 12th, and 13th, I had flown or tried to fly Rudy Voigt, a local businessman presently living in Fairbanks, to a sheep camp. And with the Super Cub, it was impossible for us to continue on our flight because it was raining so heavy that the wind was, the water was streaming as if it were from a fire hose up the windshield. And due to this, I did not have any visibility. Therefore, I returned to Fairbanks. The position at this time was at the headwaters of the Chena River. The Chena and Salsha rivers are almost, shall we say, have the same mountain for their source. After returning to Fairbanks, we flew on Sunday to McKinley Park with tourists because the railroad had a bridge that was washed out between Nenana and McKinley Park. On that trip, I observed near Suntrana that the water was coming off of the mountain in such torrents that in some places it would hit the lower level and literally splash into the air. So I knew that there was and had been a high volume of water or downpour. There again, the water was really streaming down, although the airplane I was using had more navigational equipment, so I was able to make the trip even though the other aircraft had returned to Fairbanks. On the return trip, I had tourists for Fairbanks, and Mr. McGoffin couldn't believe that I had completed the trip because he had returned, and so he queried me again, and I said, well, where are the passengers? I want to go right away. So I made the second trip to McKinley, and again I observed the torrential-like rain through the mountains by Healy. And the river was running, shall we say, above the normal bank full line at approximately 4 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. On Monday morning, I received a call to take 1,200 pounds of mail to Big Delta. It's flat country between Fairbanks and Big Delta, and although it was still raining quite heavily, I was able to fly there. And since the road had been washed out at Salsha, on the Salsha River, I had several passengers that wanted to return to Fairbanks. On arrival at approximately 10:30 in the morning, I called Maurice Smith at radio station KFAR and described the following condition to him. I said, Maurice, You know me, I do not want to create a problem, but these are the conditions. I estimate the water to be 3 feet deep in the trees 10 miles from the Tanana River, and reminded him of the water condition through the mountains on the previous day and my observations of Saturday at the headwaters of the Chena. And I said, now there's no way that this water can get by Fairbanks without giving us a flood condition. I couldn't tell him how high it was going to be, but that there was a great deal of water and that I estimated that it would take 10 days for this water to move through the Tanana River system. My report was never broadcast, and the civil defense continued to report hour after hour, river has reached a crest, until long after midnight. In 1948, I had flown Troy Payway, a geologist with the University of Alaska, and two other men from the university around looking at the geological conditions near the gold mining camps. And while we're getting in the airplane, one of the men said, I quote, "We see evidence of a flood higher than any the white man has ever seen in this valley." So I was conditioned to believe and accept the magnitude of this flood of 1967 while it was still in the making.
I was just going to interrupt you. Where did you fly Payway that you made this observation?
At that particular time, we went over to the head of Fairbanks Creek, and they had the dredge, their hydraulic operations over there had washed the cut of silt out, and there was a seam of ice that he wanted to show these other two men. Now, I don't remember the name of these two men, but they were knowledgeable geologists also, and they were all interested in erosion. I also flew them around down to Galena and McGrath, and because of my knowledge and their knowledge, we, shall we say, observed the fauna and flora of this these places. And with the possibility of, for instance, in the case of McGrath, building another airport, and it was determined that this would all be on frozen ground and the associated problems that would go with it. In other words, this project was funded by the federal government in this,
right,
their particular case. I believe that since Mr. Payway has been, shall we say, cited as a very prominent geologist, and his books or findings have been proven correct many times.
When you were flying over the upper Tanana Chena drainage and you observed a tremendous amount of water coming down from the watershed,
yes,
it was quite a distance from the river.
This it just seemed like the whole area was literally moving. You could see this. And for instance, the cows, like moose cows and calves, were on the high spot and standing in the water. For instance, on Dr. Weston's farm, the horses had found a spot higher than any, even though they were still standing in water, but it was shallower than the area down next to the fence. And for instance, I could observe see the top of the fence post on the lower end of his farm. It'll give you some idea of the problems one would have if they were living in this particular area trying to salvage their livestock.
So you then flew back, you flew on Monday then?
Right, Monday Monday morning, shall we say, Fairbanks was still quite nonchalant about the high water.
Right. It was kind of warm, I remember.
Right.
In fact, I think it stopped raining by Monday, hadn't it?
Well, Monday, during the day, it let up and the sun shone for a few hours. However, then it started raining and drizzling again, and it continued to remain like this for several days. Consequently, there was no evaporation in the area.
Do you have any idea after the flood why they didn't say more? Do you think they were concerned about alarming people, or just didn't believe that you had accurately described the situation?
Well, I think that the possibly they refused to accept this statement, since it's pretty hard to believe that this much water could accumulate, since we had no connection in the past with such a situation. In other words, they've had some floods before in the summer, I understand, but nothing that came anywhere near this. And then, too, you have to remember that we have put certain impediments in the way of the area, such as roads, dikes, bridges, which restrict the flow of the water. And so these things have funneled it into another area, too.
Right. Were you here during the flood in, I guess there was flood in 1948 or 1949, too?
I was here. The present house I own, I observed the water was within two blocks of it. So when I bought the place, I was confident that I would be on relatively high ground, and fortunately I didn't get any water damage in the house itself or on my car due to the high ground in that particular area.
Oh, either time?
Either time.
Where is it again?
Yeah, 813 on 7th. It's pretty hard to believe. Down the street by the state building, only about 4 inches of the top of a Volkswagen was out of the water, and there's that much of a difference in the variation.
I'm really surprised, because we know some people who live either in 7th or 8th near the state building who had 12, 15 inches in their first floor.
Right. Yeah. This is about right. Mm-hmm. By the way, the force of this water picked up many cars, shall we say, the unusual things, like they pick the cars right up and wash them off the road. And this one day I was out to the airport, I got one of my friends to drive me out in the motorboat so we could go flying around. And so on the way back to town the next day, we caught a ride in on an army truck, and it was kind of hard to believe that the water was still running down the middle of the what's now the airport road, roughly 3.5 feet deep.
Right. Did you put your plane down at Fairbanks Airport?
The Fairbanks International Airport had an average of 5 inches of freeboard, so to speak. In other words, mm-hmm. if the water had come up another 5 or 6 inches, it would have been on the runway itself.
Was your plane damaged at all?
No.
Flight?
My personal airplane, yes. The water got right up to and in the engine, the battery, the carburetor, but otherwise, no.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there was no damage other than the seepage of the fine silt in the water.
You say, did you fly out then during the immediate period after the flood then?
Yes, we were flying. Of course, we were, shall we say, kind of sticking our necks out. Anyone that would have had a forced landing at a time like that would have been trouble.
Right.
For instance, I flew the National Guard to Nenana, and they had men there watching the property so that it wouldn't be pilfered, and there were only about 18 inches of the top of the Nenana schoolhouse that was out of the water, and the freight cars on the railroad track, I estimated there were about maybe 3 feet of the top of the cars that was out of the water sitting on the railroad track by the dock. So it gives you some idea of the volume of water at that area.
Right.
Now that's downstream from the bridge. So in other words, you can't charge the flood there off to the building of an impediment by man, mm-hmm. because here we are, we're downstream from it, and we still got all this water there.
Right.
It's just no way of saying it except that there was just a lot of water around.
How active a part then? How active were you involved in different operations after the flood?
Well, there were many things to do. People needed to get here. For instance, because of the condition in Nenana from the Nenana flood, which came down late Sunday night and early Monday morning, we in the Interior Airways flew 173 people into Fairbanks from Nenana in the afternoon of Monday. Then, because of the Fairbanks flood, all of these people and their families that are related to the project at Clear were flown to Clear again, so that, shall we say, they got the double shuffle there in 2 days.
Mm-hmm. Were you still flying commercial at that point?
Oh, yes. I still am.
Oh, you are?
Yes, I am. In fact, I should put it this way, Bob Crum of Department of Interior, BLM in Boise, whom I just talked to a few minutes ago, said that he will, I quote, talk to the chief of the aircraft and request that I again be put on their payroll.
You fly, what kind of planes would you
fly?
Well,
I've been, BLM has made good use of my knowledge around the country, the lakes and the depths of lakes and conditions with fire control. And I generally, shall we say, the reason they use for hiring me is that of my ability to handle an amphibious aircraft, such as the Grumman Goose. This airplane, shall we say, it's like the bumblebee. It shouldn't fly, but it does a wonderful job of getting in and out of places that are almost impossible.
Right. So you've worked for Alaska, Wing, Star, and Interior.
I should put it this way. I worked for Star Airlines, then Alaska Star, then Alaska Airlines. At the time it was Star, it absorbed Cordova Air Service, which was again rescinded by the CAB, and Miro Air Service of Nome, and several other small operations. And then, of course, 20 years later, the CAB again let Alaska Airlines buy Cordova Airlines,
mm-hmm.
and approved the merger along with Coastal Ellis.
Have you much pretty much flown all over the
I know the country pretty well from, shall we say, Cordova Valdez on down into the Aleutians. And I should qualify myself by saying that for 7 years, by request, I flew for Standard Oil on their geological survey work, spending at least 3 months each summer in the Arctic. And at the time that the first discovery well was being drilled at Prudhoe Bay, by the way, I should say I was in Prudhoe Bay long before they knew what to name it. And Atlantic Richfield requested that I fly in the crew in the fall of November 1967. And so I flew this crew in there. They had no navigational aid at the station. And the one at the SAG-1, our base operations, it was also inoperative. And fortunately, I was fortunate for them that I was flying, because we flew out for approximately 35 minutes and we couldn't find the site because of the ice, fog, and haze. And in returning, it was getting dark, and I knew the main hills, and I told the man sitting next to me that those are the White Hills. We'll have to correct our course. And I said, now if we come over this hill and we don't see the lights of the runway, our next stop's Barter Island. And to give you some idea of how, shall we say, uneasy he was, he told the cook, I quote, he said, you know, he said, when I got out of that airplane, I just could have kissed the ground.
Maybe we should stop there for today and then kind of chat about some of the other things and maybe outline some of the things you'd like to cover later.
Okay. Are you ready? My name is Schultz, R.T. Schultz. I live at Fairbanks. 813 7th is my address. And the incident about which I would like to relate to you today is on Friday, February 21st, 1975, is a sighting of the Japanese balloons during World War II. I was employed by Star Airlines, then later Alaska Airlines, as a bush pilot. In the winter of 1943-44, as a pilot flying the mail to the lower Yukon, I had occasion to listen to a report from another pilot. His name was Tony Gomez. He had a mechanic with him, and they were going down, flying down the river to repair another aircraft which had a bent propeller. Mr. Gomez, or Pilot Gomez, was flying along in restricted visibility due to snow and ice fog, a combination that's quite common in that area. While he's following the river, since he had no navigational aids other than the compass in the airplane, he noticed four unusual objects floating along in the air at approximately the same height as the airplane. Now, he tells me later that he was flying at approximately 1,000 feet. He asked the mechanic Hutchinson to get the shotgun from the back seat and assemble it while he made a 360 degree turn, hoping to be adjacent to these balloons when he completed the turn. And he hoped, of course, that Mr. Hutchinson would have the shotgun assembled and loaded by that time. When they completed their circle, the balloons were missing. They didn't see them again. And since he didn't have anything to prove his statement, he was ridiculed by everyone, including the people in his own company. For instance, he was asked what he'd been drinking when he made this said report. So 5 days later, I was flying down the river under similar weather conditions, since the weather was, visibility was quite low, probably about a mile or so in snow, and restricted by this very fine fog that seems to mix with the snow when you have a temperature in the 20s. That's plus 20 Fahrenheit. As they rounded the Devil's Elbow, making a right-hand turn in Balanca, NAN 10365, the aircraft was on skis, I noticed out of the right side of the window two dark objects floating along not more than half a mile away. I didn't get a chance to get another look at these two, but I estimated that I was flying at an altitude of approximately 400 feet, and they were probably at or near the same altitude, possibly 500. I flew onto Fortuna Ledge and landed, and I didn't mention this to anyone because I didn't expect anyone to believe me following the ridicule of the previous pilot. However, a few days later, I returned to Fortuna Ledge on the next mail trip, and here was a high-speed airplane sitting on the ice, and they had this big green object with a mini guy lines attached to it, and I found that this was one of the balloons that I had sighted. It had been picked up by one of the sergeants in the Alaska National Guard as he was on his trap line. A coded message had been sent to the military in Anchorage, and they refused to believe the coding, even though Colonel Marston told them that he trusted the man who sent the message. While I was gassing up and they were loading this balloon and the associated equipment, I asked the individual who was in charge for the military what he was going to do with it. He said, I quote, "We have a DC-4 in Anchorage and a crew resting. That airplane is full of gas, and when we get there, the next stop will be Washington, D.C. I said, "Well, what do you think of this thing?" Had he said, "Well," he said, "the payload on this looks like it's a germ warfare." He said, "This box of gelatin, like suet, something shall we say that germs could survive in." And the box was approximately the same size as a box that would hold some honey from a honey bee house. I'd like to describe this a little bit at this time. This had a bamboo hook approximately a yard or more in diameter, and all of the ropes, that guy ropes that went over the top of the balloon, were attached to this bamboo hook. In addition, there were holes drilled circular around the center of this piece of bamboo, and each had a cartridge in it, and there was an aneroid device that was sensitive to altimeter change or altitude change or barometric pressure change, which would fire these cartridges, which in turn would kick off a 1 pound sack of sand or thereabouts. I didn't weigh them, but it was approximately a pound. The bag portion of this balloon was of a very tough wax paper. As you know, at that time we didn't have the type of foils and items that are, shall we say, practically gas proof at this time. When I returned to Fairbanks, I called up Stanley Baskin from the FBI and mentioned the piece of material that I had procured from this, and he drove down to my place immediately and picked this up. As you probably have read, or at least I will say that Reader's Digest had a write-up on these balloons, and in that write-up it stated that there were approximately 3,700 balloons and no known damage at the time or in the immediate period after they were released. However, a Sunday school class did find one in Oregon, and it was a shrapnel type bomb, and these children, in beating this, apparently set it off, killing approximately 10, and 22, I believe, were injured. As the Reader Digest pointed out, because there was no remarks made of it, they, it was considered the best kept secret of the war. If you'll read the book, The Thousand Mile War, they mention in there, in one place where in the Aleutians, they shot up an estimated 214,000 pounds of powder, shooting at an object shown on radar, but not otherwise able, were they able to contact. As you know, a radar, at least at that time, they only had the ability to measure the angle and the distance. Consequently, they had either shot these things down or they had risen and been carried away by the wind. It's only later that they realized that what they had been shooting at. I think that pretty well covers the subject. Colonel Marston is still living in Anchorage. He has written a book on the Alaska National Guard, and I don't remember the name of the book, although I do have a copy of it. And he mentions this in there. He also mentions in his book about an Eskimo woman in the moonlight at Selawik, walking from the old village to the new village and looking up and seeing this balloon cross the moon. As you can imagine, the consternation of this, or apprehension of this individual, not understanding or interpreting what she had seen. As he said, she put both hands over her head thinking that it was going to fall on her. End of subject.
So that was, what time again we were talking?
This was in this 1943-44.
So they would have been launched from Japan rather than from the Aleutians.
From somewhere, if they could have been launched just a few miles off the western Alaska coast.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know. But this thousand-mile war deal fixes the position of some of these and their intent. And for instance, these battleships, after shooting up all this powder, were ready to go home. Any questions?
Did you ever hear from Baskins again when he took the fabric from you?
I understand that he moved to Juneau, and he's a lawyer practicing in Juneau, although I have never had a chance or an occasion to contact him since.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions?
No, I think that's all. The mountain village you're talking about was where?
Mountain village is shall we say, as the native says, one native asked the other down on the Yukon where he's from. He says, I am up there from the place where they have rocks. That's the mountain village, is the last hill on the north side of the Yukon, and from there on it's all fine silt and sand, and the river meanders and changes its course very easily because of this very fine sediment.
Were there more balloons spotted in that area?
Yeah, well, later spotted all over. Some of them got clear up here by Wiseman and in this area.
How about in southeastern, along the Aleutians?
As I said, it was the best kept secret of the war. There was whenever this came up, it was all kept right, the minimum of conversation on it. And I only know of one other pilot that was chartered by the military to pick one up later, and that's John Holshizer.
Did you ever hear what was contained in the boxes?
No, absolutely. This is why I'd like to get this other book or information and read up on it.
Mm-hmm. So I just turn off now then?
Okay.
Did you want to talk about the Kotzebue sighting?
Right.
Why don't we go right on to that?
Okay. My subject is a little bit different. The date is much later. In September 62, I was flying out of Kotzebue. I was supposed to be on the big aircraft, but again, I got stuck with a deal that somebody else didn't want. So on September 14th, I was flying between Kotzebue and Cape Thompson. I generally stayed overnight at Cape Thompson after doing the shopping or expediting, picking up the mail for the Cape Thompson project. This particular afternoon, the clouds were approximately 2,500 feet, and I decided to climb to 6,500 at 6,500 because it looked so clear up above. And approximately 3:15, while I was en route and probably about halfway to Cape Thompson, I saw a peculiar cylindrical type cloud rise far above the other clouds to approximately a west-southwest position from my position at that time, then roughly half or two-thirds of the way to Cape Thompson. In the evening, I mentioned this to the radio man, and he said, well, he said, we just heard on the news that the Russians have set off another atomic blast. Somehow or other, they gave this information to the Nome newspaper, and this remark was carried in the local paper, and I was ridiculed by most of the people, including the pilots and president of Wing Airlines. However, on September 22nd, I had left Cape Thompson late in the afternoon to deliver some men to Kiana, and on returning, I was just west of Noatak Village and flying at approximately 3,000 feet when I saw what I thought was an aircraft flying into or crashing in the ocean. The area to the west became lit up by what appeared to be a cloud of fire. This was so roiled, is the only word I know to describe it, wherein the dark streaks through the edges of it were boiling just like a gasoline fire. I knew that I needed a lot of information right away, so I first thing was to check the clock in the aircraft to get the time. It was 5:59, 1 minute to 6 p.m., Friday night.
What was the date again then, Tony?
September 22nd, 1962. While I watched this, looking, hoping to get other clues, I noticed that after approximately 1.25 minutes, a sphere descended from this cloud of fire. I now know that it wasn't a burning gasoline when I could see this object descend from it. As you know, at night there's no depth perception since I couldn't tell how close to the surface it was or also how far away it is. It took this sphere approximately between 35 and 40 seconds to descend until it was below the horizon. As you know, with the rate of descent fixed at approximately 120 feet per second, one could figure out approximately how high this cloud of fire was. This fire continued to boil and roll as around the edges, as I described the gasoline fire. Looked the streaks around the edges of it, the dark smoke looked very similar. but had I noticed then that there appeared on the surface a rosy glow. I attribute this to this ball of fire having descended to the surface. After approximately 2 minutes, the air had probably expanded, and through the middle of this area were two white lines. These lines were as straight as if they were drawn by a yardstick and parallel to one another. I called them lines of pressure, and in a sense it's right, since this explosion had driven the pressure away, they were probably lines of negative pressure. After approximately 3 minutes, the fire, the pool of fire as I'll call it, was cooling off and disintegrating, and there seemed to be some fallout or ash between this and the ground. At the end of 4 minutes, the cloud had of fire had disappeared. However, there was still this rosy glow just over the horizon. As you know, our newspaper people told us that the Russians were setting this off at a point approximately 1,200 miles northwest of East Cape in Siberia, yet the sightings I observed were within approximately 100 miles to the west, I estimate, of East Cape. Then the next, since this was Friday night, there wasn't any action taken Saturday or Sunday. However, Secretary Bartlett, or no, excuse me, Senator Bartlett, on Monday morning was called into President Kennedy's office. He was given a short piece or strip of teletype paper, and President Kennedy said, "Senator Bartlett, do you know this man?" And Senator Bartlett told me later, he said, "I not only know this man, I've flown with him." And he said, "Well, can we rely on his report?" And Bartlett said, "Absolutely." At this time then, President Kennedy had a U-2 go over the area and remain there until he was out of fuel and glided 150 miles into Kotzebue without the use of his engine. At that time, the Kotzebue field was closed, and the Air Force came over there. One picked up his photographs, two fueled up the airplane, and then later opened the field to other traffic. All of what I have told you is true. I feel that this is the greatest contribution I could have made to my country. Later on in the week, we had a man from the Atomic Energy Commission in Las Vegas come up to measure the radiation and fallout, and I was given the assignment of flying him up and down the coast in order that he might check this fallout. And although we never did receive any reports on it, I was with him when he checked one of his filters, and as he says, it wasn't too bad, it only hit the peg. As you know, later on, Senator Bartlett insisted that we have the Hanford Atomic Energy Project send a man up here to check the horns of the caribou and the baby's teeth. I haven't heard of them coming up here recently, but I do know that they're still saving the teeth. Any questions?
I was going to ask you just a few. My quick calculation would lead me to believe that the fire that you observed was probably what, 5,000 feet high at a point four.
Somewhere. Now, 5,000 feet above my curve of the Earth, that could have made it when you figure 200 miles or thereabouts. This could make it much more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you see, I'm only going by line of sight.
Right. You say you saw one large cylindrical cloud, and then a couple days later was this.
Eight days later.
Did they ever explain what the first cloud was, or was that?
No, there's no explanation on either one of them, as far as I know. I mean, this is where we get into this detente bit, as you have read in Reader's Digest here again, shall we say, last year, about this deal about the State Department wanting to, shall we say, stay on good terms rather than confront someone and say, we have proof to such and so.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. For instance, the Air Force man, when I filed my report, I filed this report with Kotzebue Radio. I said, this is Wien 3-1 Delta. Be advised, the Russians have set off another atomic blast. I didn't say I think or maybe. I said, be advised. The time was that I observed this was 5:59. It lasted for 4 minutes. Advise military intelligence, and this is not for news release. So that put the lid on that. Then the following Tuesday, after, shall we say, the information was confirmed by seismic elsewhere in the world, the commanding officer of the Kotzebue Air Base came to me and said, I quote, we didn't believe you, but when the time you reported was confirmed to the minute elsewhere in the world, we had to believe that you saw what you reported. In other words, it took this long to get somebody to believe even a little bit.
To a non-flyer, Tony, if you were, how high were you flying at the time of the incident?
Approximately 3,000 feet. I knew I had to have 3,000 feet or more because it was getting dark and I had all these low hills around.
What kind of visibility would you have typically at 3,000 feet?
Well,
in terms of
it had just stopped raining. In both cases, I was fortunate in that it, the weather in the first case on September 14th, we'd had this low cloudy condition, and it, when it is like that and clears up, the air gets crystal clear. The same thing in this second case, this storm had come down from the low pressure area, come down out of the northwest, and when it does, it just washes the air just crystal clear. You could see, shall we say, an object to a great distance, you know, if it were big enough.
I was just wondering what you could see. I have no idea.
Well, here again at night, I have the lights turned up on the airplane because basically I'm flying on instruments because I know I got to have this much altitude, and it's pitch black. And I mean, there's no moon. It's just plain pitch black. And all of a sudden, this thing startles me right out of my wits, you know. You can't believe the reaction you get until you're faced with some of these things,
mm-hmm.
because you never, there's no connection with the past. You can't go and read up on it or anything like that. Suddenly, it's there. I might add that I was later queried by the OSI man for almost 3 hours, in which he asked me many questions, and in each case I had to refer to the fact that it was after dark and that I know that there's no depth perception after dark. You can't measure the distance, so we just have to judge and estimate this item. And his closing question to me was, well, how did you feel? And my remark was that to think that some individual, representative of government or otherwise, could trigger a device of this kind, and that someone else or many others would be in a position where there would be no way of escaping.
Was this the first time you'd seen a U-2 utilized in Alaska?
I want to correct you on that. I did not see the U-2. I only know about the incident because I'm following the situation. I was advised that the U-2 was in Kotzebue and the field was closed, I returned to my point of departure.
You were working in the Cape Thompson project in the early 60s.
Plowshare, whatever you want to call it.
Did you know people like Don Cook and Pruitt, I think?
Yeah.
Don Foote, I'm sorry, Foote.
Foote.
Yeah.
I can't place him, but Pruitt, all I can remember is Pruitt says, "Well, don't shoot the bear in the head."
Really?
As he was clawing through the James Way hut, and this man is saying, let's put it this way, this man works up here at the Fox on this project for Krell, and he said, there I am, I got this 45, and then the bear is looking me in the face and drooling, and the Pruitt's saying, don't shoot him in the head, he wants to save the head. While I was also on that project, I got quite well acquainted with the most famous fish biologist on the West Coast, Lauren Donaldson. And I flew him around, and he said, there's some dead fish down there. I said, you want to pick it up? I'd just land on sandbar someplace, and he just thought that was all right.
Uh-huh.
And he later had a... in fact, just a few days before this, he had an attack. Apparently, he had an ulcer, and I had to fly him into Kotzebue. And the reason that I was going back to Cape Thompson this particular night was that I had had 5 emergency flights in the afternoon or after dark in the previous week, so I felt that even though the runway wasn't lighted, that I should go back there and spend the night. I was supposed to be best man at a wedding in Kotzebue, and of course, there again, I didn't make that.
Just to briefly recap, you were born, 1909,
right.
Where were you born?
In Bristol, South Dakota.
So your father was
just a few miles, 11 miles from where Jerome Lardy was.
Oh, really? Oh. Yeah, that's a real coincidence. Yeah. So your father, after he finished up in Nome, what, about 1906,
1907?
Fall 1906. Uh-huh. He went back to Bristol then?
Yes. Yeah. And he bought the first automobile. He had a EMF. And I don't know what the EMF stands for now, but he had an EMF car that cost approximately the same price as a car that would today, roughly $3,500. And then he later was a salesman or agent for him, and he sold one to his brother-in-law. To give you some idea of the lack of understanding, the man had plenty of money. He could drive his horses. But when he drove the car up to one of the garage he built, he yelled, "Whoa," and he didn't grab for the brake. Consequently, he went right out through the other side. Now, instead of trying to drive his car a little more proficiently before he finished his garage again, he reinforced the garage wall by using 2x6s because he was going to be sure he stopped inside on the second try.
It's a tough way to stop.
This, again, I'm saying these are thinking, and it's our machinery and everything has changed so much in one lifetime.
It really has, hasn't it? It really has. Mm-hmm. I've never dreamed of going several hundred miles an hour 50, 60 years ago.
Even seeing somebody go to the moon.
Yeah. Why don't we turn this off, and then maybe we can talk about having come out again sometime at your leisure and talk about some of your flying experiences.
Well, you can. I got a couple of the good ones there, and there are many others, but I was trying to get together with Jim Greiner.
Jim Minch, I talked to Jim this morning, and he said he was trying to get hold of you, I guess.
I've been trying to get a hold of him.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. I don't want to write a book by Sheldon. I feel that Sheldon's book is an inducement for some young fellow to come along and say, well, Sheldon did it, now I can do it too, and I claim that it will increase the accident rate of these inexperienced people.
Mm-hmm.
Where what I want to show is the progress that has been made in aviation and how people have accepted it. For instance, it's kind of hard for you people to believe my story, but it's true. I was flying into McGrath and Ophir during the war, 1942, I believe. And this couple, elderly couple, were living out on the creek. I don't remember their name now, but they were approximately 15 miles out of town. This woman was a Finlander, I believe, and so they didn't get much mail. She couldn't read the magazines or most of the newspapers, except the one month issue that they did get from Finland. And consequently, she's relatively isolated out there, and I believe they said she didn't come to town for over 3 years, although it was only 11 miles over the hill. Fortunately, I was there the day she did come to town. And so the other woman told her in Finnish that, she said, well, there's the pilot that's been dropping your mail to you all these months when you've been out there. And so she came over and got down on her knees and looked up at me and said, you're too young to be flying something like that. It's pretty hard for us to accept this statement now, but that's the way she looked at the situation then.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty hard to put this into, some way that someone coming along, seeing everything as we have it today, and understand this person and her line of thinking. In fact, even being out there in the sticks that far, all they were doing was a little trapping, and they tried to prospect for gold, and they would shoot a moose or two, and they had their little log cabin with the tin roof, and they would order a few clothes, and her husband would walk to town and buy a few supplies to get by on. Needless to say, they didn't have any electrics or running water.
Right. Why don't we cut this in right now?